At 8:03 a.m. Tokyo time on April 18, 1942, Lieutenant Colonel James Jimmy Doolittle pushed the throttles up on his B-25 Mitchell bomber and started on a shockingly short 467-foot takeoff roll from the deck of the USS Hornet. Doolittle was leading an audacious air attack against the Japanese home islands, the United States' first retaliation against the Japanese for the devastating attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. On the 80th anniversary of one of the most famous air operations ever, I'll analyze the Doolittle Raid on this episode of the Air Minded Podcast. Air Minded Podcast. Welcome back, Air Minded listeners. I'm your host, Tyson Gorilla Wetzel. Many of you found this podcast because of the episodes I've done on the Ukraine Air War, the four episodes I put out so far, the four most listened to episodes of this podcast. I understand that many of you are here for that content, and don't worry about it. I've got a couple of episodes in the hopper to cover specific components of the Ukraine Air War, but if you stumbled on this podcast for Ukraine Air War content, I hope you'll stick around for this talk about the Doolittle Raid. This is really kind of the DNA of this podcast, is to talk about critical events of air power history. So if you're listening to this, it's probably on or around Monday the 18th of April, which marks the 80th anniversary of the famous Doolittle Raid. And I couldn't let that anniversary pass without taking a deep dive into the raid, how it was planned, how it was executed, the importance of the mission, not only to the course of World War II in both the Pacific and the Atlantic theaters, but also how it's important even today. And to tie in the Ukraine Air War, there was a mission that the Ukrainian Air Force executed, a helicopter attack into Russia that many commentators were calling it their Doolittle Raid. I think it's a little bit of a stretch, but anyways, we'll talk about that in the enduring importance of the raid section of this podcast. But to get back to the point that I was making, that this type of podcast or this type of episode is really at the heart of what I do here at the Air Minded Podcast. When I started this a little bit over a year ago, the intent was to increase the knowledge and understanding of critical events, people, and stories of air power history. And in the Air Force, I feel like there's not enough appreciation of our history. We don't embrace the history, the stories, the events, the battles that are really important to the service as a whole, as some of the other military services. And I feel like there's not enough coverage of and appreciation of some of those critical events and people. And boy, the Doolittle Raid has that in spades in terms of critical events and critical people that play a huge role in the founding of the United States Air Force as an independent service, and then what it has done over the last nearly 80 years. The first episode that I ever published on the Air Minded Podcast was on Operation Bolo, what I think is just a brilliantly planned and executed aerial sweep mission that devastated the North Vietnamese MiG-21 fleet. It's one of my favorite air power missions to read and learn about. It's second probably only to the Doolittle Raid. And I think the Doolittle Raid, as we talk about it, I'll get into my feelings on it, but I think it played a pretty critical role in halting Japanese momentum in the Pacific. A lot more through the psychological impact of the raid than really the physical damage that it caused, which was relatively minor. I'm going to cover this mission in four parts: the strategic context around the raid, the conception of and the development of the plan, the execution of the mission, and then finally the legacy of the raid. A real quick note on sources I used. I've read a bunch of books, but there's going to be four that I'm going to give to you right now that I would recommend. And don't worry, I'll put them all in the podcast notes and then post it on my social media accounts. My favorite, if you're going to read just a single volume on the Doolittle Raid, I think the best, at least that I've read, is James Scott's Target Tokyo. I think that's excellent. I also used and really like reading first-person accounts of really any air power mission or history. But in this case in particular, I read the Jimmy Doolittle's autobiography, I Could Never Be So Lucky Again. we're only going to talk a little bit about Doolittle's history outside of the raid, but he's an incredibly important air power pioneer. And then, of course, he ends up leading 8th Air Force in the Atlantic theater of operations later in his career, or later in this war. So obviously super important. So in addition to his account, I also read Ted Lawson's 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. Finally, if I were going to recommend one other kind of book, this one covers a little bit of the raid, but a lot more what happened after is Last Mission to Tokyo by Michael, I'm going to screw up his last name, Paradis, maybe? P-A-R-A-D-I-S. I screw up all kinds of names on this thing. Anyways, Last Mission to Tokyo covers the post-conflict war crimes trials of Japanese guards who, in some cases, tortured and killed some members of the crew that were captured. It's a really interesting book that gets into what happened to some of those crews that were captured. Some of them made it home, some of them didn't. It's a unique look at not just the planning of the raid, but what happened after, both immediately after the raid and then throughout the war, and then even covers some of the things that happened to some of the individuals that came home well after the war. So I recommend all four of those. Anyways, with all of that buildup, let's get into talking about the Doolittle Raid. All right, part one is the strategic context. And there's a couple of things that, big picture, that I really want to talk about or hammer home in strategic context. The first is that U.S. Army Air Forces were really ill-equipped and unprepared for the beginning of U.S. involvement in World War II. And then the second was that there was a string of losses that the United States was suffering, in particular in the Pacific. And there was almost a mental block, if you will, or there's really a psychological dread that is going on in the U.S. And that's really important because the Doolittle Raid will break that kind of mentality. So let's start with the U.S. Army Air Forces. So a lot of people always call the Air Force at that time, the Air Corps. Actually, it's the U.S. Army Air Forces in June 20th of 1941 that was transitioned from the Army Air Corps to the Army Air Forces. So I'll be talking about the U.S. Army Air Forces. At the start of World War II, that organization was pretty small. It was starting to build up, but it was ill-equipped. It was a second or third level Air Force, not at all ready to take on the Nazis and the Japanese. And just to that point, in 1939, the Air Corps at the time strength was about 26,000 people. There were about 1,200 fighters and bombers. Nearly all of those were obsolete. To kind of talk about how unprepared the U.S. was, the American ace of aces, Eddie Rickenbacker, who at the time is probably considered to be the most knowledgeable, most famous aviator, probably along with Charles Lindbergh. And he said at the time that the U.S. was at least a decade behind the Nazi Luftwaffe. To that end, Congress appropriated in 1940 the development of or the production of 6,000 airplanes, which was huge, but U.S. production was not ready at the time, so wasn't really able to fill those purchases. But the U.S. about that time starts to engage in a rapid mobilization, not just in the Air Force, but really across the services. I mean, FDR had a pretty good idea what was coming, and he was pushing as far as he could in what was still a relatively isolationist country to build up the forces, not if, but really when the U.S. Became involved in World War II. I think it's important to talk about where the Air Force went or how they got there. So 1939, we're talking 1,200 fighters, many of which are still open cockpit, World War One kind of looking type of aircraft, to by 1945, the then Army Air Forces would be 2.4 million people, 80,000 planes, most of which had been built during the 4 years of U.S. intervention in World War II. There is no doubt that the U.S. was the best Air Force in the world, and then less than 2 years later, it would become independent as the United States Air Force. But going back to where we are on December 7th of 1941, there's simply not enough aircraft for either the European or the Pacific theater. Hawaii was really, there are some Army Air Forces aircraft out there, but it's a small number and certainly not enough to defend the island. And that kind of transitions to the second point that I wanted to get to on the strategic context, which is at the time of the Doolittle Raid, the U.S. was mired in a series of losses throughout the Pacific theater. Of course, it started with Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. Of course, we know, we've seen the pictures, we know the story about what happened to Battleship Row and all the ships that were sunk or heavily damaged in Pearl Harbor, but also Army Airfield across the Big Island, or across Oahu, what was known as the Hawaiian Air Force, was hit, and multiple aircraft were destroyed, or dozens of aircraft were destroyed. A few took off, and actually there were a couple of U.S. kills in the air, but overall the Hawaiian Air Force was pretty well decimated. But it was not just Pearl Harbor. Just a few hours later, on the 8th of January, or excuse me, on the 8th of December in the Pacific, Japan was really on the march throughout the region. So the Japanese forces nearly annihilated the U.S. Army Air Forces in the Pacific, which was known as the U.S. Far East Air Force. They were headquartered in the Philippines. Now, we could probably do our own podcast or a separate podcast on why didn't General MacArthur, when he was given a heads up that there was an attack underway in Hawaii, why didn't he disperse his aircraft? That's really going to be beyond the scope here. However, most of the aircraft were sitting on runways, and the Japanese nearly annihilated what little air power was in the Pacific theater at the time. So although they did not land the knockout blow, and I'll talk about that, the Japanese did a pretty good job of putting a big hurt on not just the U.S. Navy, but also the Army Air Forces in the Pacific at the time. So after the initial strikes on Pearl Harbor in the Philippines, that kind of same day, there's hits at Guam and Wake Island, British territories of Malaya, which is now Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong. Just a couple of days later, the Japanese take Thailand. So everything looks really, really bad in those early days of December. But if you look just kind of one level below, you realize that despite the victories, Japan didn't land that knockout blow. And probably, there's a lot of people that have analyzed what happened in Pearl Harbor, but really two things that I see as reasons why they didn't land that knockout blow was, first off, they missed the carriers, whether it was luck or what. We did not have our carriers in Pearl Harbor on that day, and thus we still had the ability to generate air power from the sea, and that will be pretty decisive. And this war is really the first time that we get decisive air battles over the sea. It's pretty a whole nother set of episodes that we could talk about. So number one, they didn't knock out the aircraft carriers. And number two, they didn't hit the fuel storage facilities on Hawaii. And there were millions and millions of gallons of aviation fuel that were housed on Hawaii, that the destruction of which could have caused significant issues. So the Japanese, although they put the U.S. on the back foot with the Pearl Harbor strike, did not end realistic U.S. Ability to fight back in the Pacific. But the string of defeats continues really up through that winter and into the beginning of spring of 1942. In January, Japan invaded Burma, the Dutch East Indies, New Guinea. On February 15th, Fortress Singapore fell, devastating at the time. Winston Churchill called it the darkest day of the war. And things are looking terrible. On February 19th, there's a large-scale Japanese air attack on Darwin, Australia. The question is, where are the Japanese going to end? Are they going to take all of the Asia Pacific? Are they going to invade Australia? March 11th, General MacArthur is forced to leave the Philippines. Bataan falls on April 9th. That leads to the famous or infamous Bataan Death March. And then eventually the Philippines would fall at the beginning of May. So this is the strategic context that exists in the United States in the Pacific in the early days of 1942. It is a string of defeats. There is this kind of pall over the American people that we are just, we're on the back foot, we're losing battles up and down the Pacific. And there is a need to change the game, to take the offense and to stop the Japanese momentum in the Pacific theater. To that point, even as early as December 21st, so just 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor, FDR, in a meeting with his closest military advisors, says, get me a plan to strike at the Japanese. We have to hit them, and we have to do it quickly. And out of that comment, if you will, that is where we get the genesis of the Doolittle Raid. And that's what I'm going to cover in part two, which will look at the conception and development of the plan and the idea for the Doolittle Raid. All right, part two, let's talk about the development of the plan. So I already alluded to a pretty famous meeting that happened on December 21st, 1941. President Roosevelt was meeting with his closest war advisors. And this is just 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. In fact, the ships were still smoking in the harbor, and there were still survivors that they were attempting to pull out. So it is all very visceral to the team there. And Roosevelt was very insistent upon being able to take the fight to Japan and be able to strike them. And there were a couple of problems with this at that time. The first is that there is no Army airfields or ground-based airfields that are close enough to be able to support bomber strikes into Japan. Although the U.S. was allied with China at the time, there were no airfields that were close enough to be able to get bombers there to hit Japan and then be able to come back safely. And the problem with carrier aviation, though it would be incredibly effective throughout the rest of the fight, the rest of the war, is that the most carrier strikers or strike fighters have relatively short range, relatively short legs, if you will. And there was no aircraft in the naval inventory that would be able to take off from a carrier, fly a few hundred miles to hit the target, and then come back and have that carrier be a safe enough distance away from Japan. So there was nothing in the inventory at the time of this meeting, at least that people believed would be able to allow the military to meet Roosevelt's request. I like a quote that from then Lieutenant General Henry Hap Arnold. He was chief of the United States Army Air Forces at the time, and he said of that meeting, "The president was insistent that we find ways and means of carrying home to Japan proper, in the form of a bombing raid, the real meaning of this war." So it was pretty clear what Roosevelt was looking for. In the next couple of weeks, another hero of our story who doesn't get a whole lot of credit, because it's, you know, Doolittle gets a lot of the credit, is actually from the Navy. Navy Captain Francis Lowe pitched what he called himself a foolish idea to Admiral Ernest King, who just at the beginning of January of 42 became the U.S. Fleet Commander. And Lowe had been out at Norfolk in Virginia, which is, he was checking out the progress of a new carrier that was being built, the USS Hornet. It was out on a couple of week cruise, basically to make sure that this vessel was ready to go and would eventually be assigned to the Pacific. While Lowe was there observing the progress of these mission checks for the Hornet, he saw that there was an airstrip there at Norfolk, and they had the equivalent of a carrier air landing deck that was painted on the ground, and he saw aircraft taking off nearly constantly. And something about seeing this sparked an idea in his mind, and what he thought was, you know, if we don't have the ability, we as in the Navy have the ability to get an aircraft all the way to Tokyo and some of the other critical targets in Japan, then perhaps if we could get an Army bomber to take off from a Navy aircraft carrier, if they could take off at a very short distance, maybe they could launch from an aircraft carrier, bomb Japan, maybe even Tokyo, and then still have the range to be able to land at a ground-based airfield, something like in China. So the very kind of seedling of an idea that would eventually become the Doolittle Raid. Now, Francis Lowe was pretty worried that in pitching this to Admiral King. So there's some great quotes, and I didn't write this down, but I think it was Admiral King's daughter said something like he was the most even-handed man or the most consistent man in the Navy. He was always in a bad mood. I think that's a pretty bad paraphrase of what I think it was his daughter said. But the bottom line is he was a tough character to get along with. And he didn't suffer fools greatly or easily. So Lowe figured that he was going to be yelled at and King was going to throw him out. But King actually, Admiral King didn't dismiss the idea out of hand at all. And he liked it. And he told Lowe to go socialize the idea in particular with the Army Air Forces. One of the people that he told him to, that King told Lowe to go talk to was his air operations officer, Captain Donald Duncan. And Duncan went and did some research, and by looking through intelligence they had on the Japanese naval forces and protection of the home islands, what Captain Duncan was able to determine was that Japan patrolled their waters about 300 miles away from the coast. So any aircraft that would be taking off from an aircraft carrier had to be able to take off from greater than 300 miles away, had to be able to bomb the target, and then be able to reach China post-strike. So this came up with the basis of the idea. This is the kind of range that we needed. Duncan looked and knew there was nothing in the naval inventory, so went and looked at the Army inventory and came up with a couple of different bomber ideas that might be able to make it. What he ended up determining was the B-25 Mitchell bomber was the most likely aircraft that would be able to meet the specifications outlined in his very basic research. Duncan also knew as an air operations officer that the Hornet was going to be moving from the Norfolk to the Pacific, which is where it was going to be assigned when it was ready. And finally, he did some research on weather and found that in that part of the northern Pacific, a favorable weather window would exist really just from mid-April to mid-May, and then it would become increasingly difficult to try and be able to get the task force all the way to Japan and the aircraft safely off the deck and to the target. So now he had an idea of range, an idea of aircraft, an idea of timing. So with this initial work done, both Lowe and Duncan briefed King what they knew, and King, Admiral King authorized them to brief General Arnold of the plan, which is what they did. And General Arnold, and to his credit, did not dismiss it because it was a different service that came up with the idea. He was actually very enthusiastic about the plan, and he knew who he could trust to look into it, and that was Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle. So let me just take a minute here to talk about who Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle was. He enlisted in the Army Signal Corps in 1917. He was commissioned and got his wings in March of 1918, but unfortunately was not able to fly in the war. He was an instructor pilot through the rest of the U.S.'s intervention in World War I, and that bothered him a long time. And later, rejoined the Army, and I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but when he rejoined the Army in 1940, he said he didn't want to miss out on another war because he was upset that he missed out on this war. One of those things in timing, he was not able to get over to the European theater. Anyways, during the interwar period between World War I and World War II, Doolittle became one of America's most famous aviators. He flew in air races, he set records for transcontinental flights, a bunch of speed records, etc. But he was also a very cerebral individual and thought about flying aircraft as more than just, you know, a good time. He also looked at it from a very scientific perspective. And to that end, he actually got the Air Force to send him to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. And there he got a master's and got it in only 1 year. And the Air Force had agreed to pay for two, so he decided to go get his doctorate. And he got his doctorate in aeronautical engineering from MIT, so that's pretty impressive. But more impressive, I think, that was the first doctorate in aeronautical engineering ever given in the United States, and it went to then-Captain Doolittle. Lots of records that he set, and he was one of those, along with like Lindbergh and Rickenbacker, who really brought aviation to the forefront in the interwar period. But that, I don't think, is his most lasting legacy, at least during this period. And that was his contribution, where he was using his knowledge of aeronautical engineering. In particular, he did some pioneering work on instrument flying, and he believed that weather and illumination and being able to fly in poor weather and darkness would be critical to the development of both civil and military aviation. And to that end, in 1929, he completed the first completely blind flight. He took off, he flew, and then landed in airfield using instruments only. He had the cockpit blacked out to show that the use of instruments would allow safer flying. And this eventually, today every aircraft has instruments that you can fly off of. But he was the first that was really leading the way on this. In the interwar period, he left active duty. He went to go work for Shell Oil Company. And while he was there, he pioneered 100-octane aviation fuel. That would eventually become really important to high-performance flying, in particular military aviation in World War II. In 1940, as I kind of already alluded to, he decided it was time to come back to active duty. When it looked like war was pretty likely, he did not want to miss out on another war, so said to Arnold, I don't care what you do with me, just try to use the special skills that I have. And Arnold, of course, was able to find a good use for Jimmy Doolittle. The first thing before he was assigned the Doolittle raid, General Arnold sent him to England in 1941 to observe and learn about modern air operations in the European theater and see what he could take away. At this point, Roosevelt, as well as most of his staff, knew that it wasn't a question of if, but when the United States would be in World War II, so he wanted to be prepared. And as I mentioned, Congress had already authorized a large increase in the Army Air Forces, but equipment alone was not going to be enough. They needed to learn how to be able to fly a modern war. So that was part of Doolittle's remit in Europe, was to go figure out how air operations of the day were being conducted. At the time that this story is kind of playing out, in December of 41 and January of 42, Doolittle was known as a problem solver. If you had a tough problem, then he was somebody that you would go to. And Hap Arnold happened to have a wicked problem to give to have solved. So he brought Doolittle into the plan. He told him about Lowe and Duncan's idea, and he said, test this idea and turn it into an executable plan. According to General Doolittle, he said, and this is a quote, "This is your baby. You'll have the first priority on anything you need to get the job done. Get in touch with me directly if anybody gets in your way." And that was pretty important. And I won't get into all the times that Doolittle had to invoke General Arnold's name, but certainly it was a few. So it was made pretty clear. Arnold made it pretty clear that this is going to be a high priority and it's going to be more important than anything else you're going to do. Doolittle called the mission Special Aviation Project Number 1, and despite the work that Lowe and Duncan had done on the Navy side, he decided to kind of redo all of the calculations and try to determine his own plan. And he settled on the B-25 Mitchell bomber as the only aircraft that could carry enough fuel and bombs to accomplish the mission, to potentially be able to take off in a short enough distance to fly off of an aircraft carrier while still having enough fuel to reach China. So independent of Lowe and Duncan's analysis, he was able to determine to come to the same conclusion that the B-25 was the right aircraft. And the way that Doolittle did this is he started with the math. He thought the bombers would have to take off from as far as 500 miles east of Tokyo. They'd have to be able to drop their bomb load, about 2,000 pounds of bombs each, and then they'd have to travel at least 1,200 more miles to the friendly controlled areas of China. Remember, at this point, Japan had invaded, in particular, northern China. So just getting to China wasn't enough. It would have to be to get to friendly controlled nationalist parts of China. So he combined those numbers and then gave a little bit of a buffer and said an aircraft needs to be able to fly 2,400 miles to complete this mission, fly from the aircraft carrier to the targets in Tokyo and around there, and then fly all the way to the friendly occupied areas of China. The B-25's stated range at the time was 1,300 miles, so nearly half or just over half of what was being proposed by Doolittle as a requirement. So it's clear that the off-the-shelf B-25, if you will, wasn't going to be enough. So Doolittle went to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, which is a big engineering airfield. It still is today. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is still an area where we have Air Force Material Command. The Air Force does a lot of engineering, a lot of development of programs and aircraft and stuff like that. Doolittle got 18 B-25s that were coming off the line to be sent to Wright Field for a host of modifications by engineers there. In particular, they needed more fuel than what the aircraft was carrying. And so they worked around on a couple of different ideas. Eventually, they came up with rubber fuel bladders that would increase the amount of fuel that they could carry internal, wouldn't have a huge amount of increase in weight. I mean, by using rubber, it was a little bit less than creating, big metal fuel tanks. And then the thought was once they had used all of the fuel from these bladders, they could throw them out of the aircraft again, saving some more weight. So by increasing the amount of fuel storage, they could increase the range and start getting closer to that 2,400-mile range that Doolittle thought was going to be expected. And then critical, so increasing fuel is one, but decreasing weight was the other thing here. So Doolittle went around the aircraft with the engineers and looked for every pound that he could save by getting rid of radio equipment or even some excess guns, anything he could get rid of that would take weight away and allow the aircraft to get a little bit further. On the target side of the house, Doolittle did some look at what would be some critical targets, military and industrial sites in Tokyo and surrounding metropolitan areas near Tokyo. He studied, just like the Navy guys did, he studied the historical weather patterns, and like what Duncan came up with, Doolittle thought that really needed to move quickly because he thought by late April the weather just would not support. So he was looking at an early to mid-April as the time of execution of this mission. So independent, both the Navy and the Air Force experts are coming to the same, they're coalescing on the same idea. On February 2nd of 1942, two B-25s did the first test of a medium bomber taking off from a Navy aircraft carrier. So out just off of the coast of Norfolk, two B-25s took off from the deck of the USS Hornet, which would eventually be used on the raid. The bombers were successful, but it was close. They were able to take off in the just under 500 feet, and they saw that they had about a 6-foot clearance between their wingtip of the bombers and the ship's island. So it was doable, but it was close. Doolittle went to, so when looking for who would actually fly this mission, he wanted only volunteers, and he wanted air crew and aircraft that were going to be readily available. So new B-25s were being sent out to the 17th Bombardment Group at Columbia Army Air Base in South Carolina, and that's where Doolittle went to grab his aircraft and then also his pilot or his air crew. He was not able to provide any real details to the air crew that were there other than it was a secretive mission, it was going to be dangerous, and they need to be able to do a short takeoff. This was a training group in Columbia Army Air Base, and none of them had been in combat, and that he got more volunteers than he could use. So he was able to pick, he ended up picking 24 full crews from the volunteers, and he sent them down to Eglin Field in the panhandle of Florida, now today Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. There at Eglin is where the training got serious. They started to do mission training and rehearsals, in particular focused on short takeoffs. So a Navy aviator, Navy Lieutenant Henry Miller, was assigned to Doolittle to help the crews learn how to take off from a carrier. And they started this training at the beginning of March. So I think before we get into some of the training, Doolittle welcomed the crews with the following comment. If you men have any idea that this isn't the most dangerous thing you've ever been on, don't even start this training period. You can drop out now. He made it very clear this was going to be dangerous. They couldn't talk about it and that it was going to be important. Nobody dropped out, and he offered that deal a couple of times, and no aviators ever dropped out. During their time at Eglin, like I said, a major focus was learning short takeoff capabilities of the B-25. So Miller started with moving them back closer and closer and closer. So it would start with, you know, take off in 700 feet, take off in 600 feet, 500 feet, and keep moving them closer and closer. And as they were doing that, he would increase the weight of the bombers as well. So we'd have a very low weight of the aircraft and longer range, and then kept moving those as the crews got more and more comfortable. And most of the crews were able to get the hang of it. In addition to the takeoffs that they were working with Lieutenant Miller, they also did navigation, especially over water, navigation training, low altitude bombing training, gunnery training, to get ready for all the things that they would need to do. About this time, Captain Duncan, again, remember he was assigned from, he was the air operations officer assigned by Admiral King. He was tasked to go brief Admiral Chester Nimitz, who at the time was the commander of the Pacific Fleet, on the plan in as much detail as he could. At this point, the plan was not just for the Hornet to go to Japan, because the entire deck would pretty much be covered with B-25 bombers. They were too large to be brought into some of the holding areas down below deck of the aircraft carrier. They needed another protection carrier. So the plan also called for the USS Enterprise. At this time, before the Hornet was assigned to the Pacific, there were only two operational carriers. So when this mission would go, two of the three Pacific Fleet carriers would be called for this mission. It's a pretty big risk that Nimitz would have to run. But in addition, it's not just the two carriers, the Enterprise and the Hornet. For additional protection, four cruisers, eight destroyers, two oilers were all assigned to what would become known as Task Force 16. It was a total of 10,000 sailors, so a pretty significant mission. They'd be crossing nearly 6,000 miles of the Pacific. They'd be in radio silence. It's a pretty risky mission, but one that there wasn't really an option not to do. And Nimitz understood that. He appointed his number two, Vice Admiral William Bull Halsey, to lead the naval force. And these are all names that, of course, you probably have heard of a bunch throughout the war. There was another component of it. So we've been talking about the Army Air Forces component that are now at Eglin that are training and developing the plan. We've talked about the naval component and that large task force that would be leaving out of Oakland and Pearl Harbor, meeting up in the Pacific, and then sailing out to Japan. But there was also the component of the landing operations in China. Lieutenant General Joseph Stilwell, he was the commander of U.S. Army forces in the China-Burma-India theater. He was tasked with working the China part of the plan, and this was a really difficult situation. So the plan called for Doolittle and his raiders to hit targets in China. They were specifically told they could not land in Soviet Russia. They couldn't go to Vladivostok. They had to go to China. And they needed to reach airfields in nationalist-controlled parts of the country. So this would require the use of the Chinese nationalists led by Chiang Kai-shek. There wasn't necessarily a great relationship between Stilwell and Chiang, so there was a question of when do we tell them and how much do we tell them. I'll get into some of the details after the mission. The coordination didn't go quite right, and that's going to lead to a lot of problems for the raiders after the mission. Another problem was Stilwell was never really fully briefed on the full plan. He didn't really understand the urgency of this coordination with China. The results would be pretty poor, and it would have really significant consequences post-raid, but I'm already getting ahead of myself. So getting back to the chronology, the tick-tock, if you will, on March 4th, of 1942, the Hornet departed Norfolk for Oakland via the Panama Canal. On March 24th, Doolittle informed the 22 crews that he was going to be taking out to California. They were still going to only take, at the time, they thought 15 aircraft. Eventually, it would be 16 aircraft. But he informed 22 crews that he was going to be taking them to McClellan Field in Sacramento, California, and then on to Oakland and embarkation on the USS Hornet. At this point, he still hadn't been able to tell the crews what they were doing. Most of them figured since they were going to the Pacific, it was probably a mission to Japan, but they thought they'd maybe be taking off out of China. Nobody still had an idea. I mean, they were probably figuring out that they were going to have to do something to do with an aircraft carrier because they were taking off from such short range. Anyways, last kind of note I'll make here in portion two is that on March 30th, Doolittle met Admiral Halsey in San Francisco. They briefed each other on the respective part of the plan. And so Doolittle talked about what the aircraft would do and how his crews would execute the mission. And Halsey told him about the plan to safely get the crews to the target. So with that said, the plan is pretty well set. And as we transition from the end of March into the beginning of April of 1942, we get to the actual execution of the Doolittle raid. All right, part three, the raid itself. So we're now at the end of March. The Hornet has arrived in Oakland, Alameda Harbor. The skipper of the Hornet, a Navy legend himself, Captain Mark Mitcher, had the phrase, "Remember Pearl Harbor," painted on the ship's stack. And 16 of the heavily modified B-25 bombers were eventually lifted onto the deck of the carrier. On the night of April 1st, the crew was released for their last night in town in San Francisco before they were going to be departing the next day. Doolittle got to spend the evening with his wife, who came out to Oakland or San Francisco to spend time with him. Most of the men, not surprisingly, went out into town and enjoyed cocktails at a bar in town. The day of departure for at least this component, the Hornet component of the task force, which was known as Task Force 16-2, was scheduled. They were scheduled to depart on April 2nd of 1942. Before he left, Doolittle had messages from the Army Chief of Staff, General Marshall, from Hap Arnold, from Admiral King. And before he left that morning, General Marshall called and, as relayed in a quote in James Scott's Target Tokyo, Marshall said, "I just called to personally wish you the best of luck. Our thoughts and prayers are with you. Goodbye, good luck, and come home safely." So this is the most senior officer, a legend of the United States Army, is calling to tell Doolittle that. And probably Jimmy Doolittle didn't need the importance of the mission to be brought home anymore to him, but certainly the call from such a legend as General Marshall certainly did that. At 10:18 that morning on the April 2nd, the Hornet, with 70 Army officers and 64 enlisted men aboard, got underway. They crossed under the Golden Gate Bridge, and they headed out into the Pacific. As they got moving, Doolittle gathered his men in a wardroom and finally was able to tell them what their mission was. Of course, they had been speculating quite a bit. But he said, and I'm quoting here, "For the benefit of those of you who don't already know or who have been guessing, we are going straight to Japan. We are going to bomb Tokyo, Yokohama, Osaka, Kobe, and Nagoya. The Navy is going to take us as close as is advisable. And of course, we're going to take off from the deck." And as you can imagine, a great cheer went up among the aviators as they were, even in spite of how they must have known that it was a huge risk, they were going to be part of a historic mission. They were going to be a part of America's vengeance against Japan, against the Empire of Japan for Pearl Harbor. A little bit later in the day, Captain Mitcher addressed the entire ship and basically said kind of the same thing. He let him know where this task force was going and why. And to quote him, he said, "Now hear this. This ship will carry the Army bombers to the coast of Japan for the bombing of Tokyo." And not surprisingly, the message was met with a huge cheer from his crew as they knew the importance, just like the Army aviators did, of what they were about to do. Morale was pretty high considering how risky this mission was and the nearly 6,000 miles they still had ahead of them. So a little bit further on in the trip, Doolittle began to brief his crews on the mission specifics, and I already laid out the plan, but in general terms, it was going to be a pre-dark takeoff, late afternoon takeoff, with the first bombers hitting the targets at dusk, so they'd still have a little bit of light to be able to see where the targets were, and then the others would guide on their fires that they started. The crews would bomb across not just Tokyo, but some of those other major metropolitan areas do little mention that quote that I just read from him. It was going to be a nearly 50-mile across swath of territory that were going to be bombed. And this had a couple of reasons. First off, to increase the survivability. There weren't going to be multiple bombers going over the same location, so that increased, hopefully, their survivability. And then also, just to give the impression of a much larger strike force. I mean, it's only going to be 16 aircraft. They wanted to make it look like they were hitting a huge portion of the Japanese home islands. Doolittle, and there was much talk about this, but Doolittle ordered his crews to avoid the Imperial Palace. They would be flying over it, but he said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to hit residential areas, schools, hospital, and other non-military targets. Each bomber would carry about 2,000 pounds of bombs. With four bombs, they were going to be split between high-explosive bombs and then incendiary cluster munitions. For earthquake concerns, the most buildings were made out of wood, and incendiaries would start major fires throughout the city. The crews debated and figured at best they probably had about a 50-50% chance of survival. So a very, very daring mission. On April 8th, so this is April 2nd, they get moving out of Oakland and out of the San Francisco Harbor. On April 8th, Vice Admiral Halsey departed Pearl Harbor on the USS Enterprise, and the bulk of the Naval Task Force, which is everything else besides the Hornet and some of its escort ships. And so they steamed out, and on the 13th in the Northern Pacific, the two components of the task force, Halsey's and Mitcher's task force, meet up and create one large armada, the Task Force 16. On the Enterprise, Halsey addressed his ship and pronounced, "This force is bound for Tokyo," to which he later said was followed by the largest burst of shouting he'd ever heard on a Navy combat vessel. As the task force steamed towards Japan at a rate of 400 miles per day, the risk increased. With each mile that they got closer to Japan, there was the risk of submarines, there was the risk of detection, and then there was the risk of running into some of the Japanese aircraft carriers and potentially losing most of the Pacific combat power that was still left after Pearl Harbor. So a real big risk-reward mission going on here. According to James Scott, and I mentioned James Scott's Target Tokyo is what I would consider the best single volume on the raid. The quotes that I've been using here, unless I tell you I'm quoting them from somewhere else, just assume that they have come from Target Tokyo. Like I said, if you want to read more about this, I recommend just make itself easy on you. Do the one-touch purchase on Amazon and pick up Scott's Target Tokyo. It's excellent. So according to Scott, Doolittle was thinking to himself and kind of working it out and hoped that he would be able to get within 450 miles of Japan. If they could only get to 550 miles, he'd be okay with that, but he really set the max range or the outer edge of what would be a successful mission at 650 miles from the targets. Anything outside of that, he didn't believe that the bombers would be able to have the fuel to reach the friendly controlled airfields in China. So that's the range he was working with. He wanted to get, at a bare minimum, 650 miles from the targets, but hopefully closer into the 450 miles. They knew the mission would occur on the night of the 18th, on the really late afternoon into the early evening of the 18th. So on the night of April 17th, Doolittle met with his men for the final time, gave them one more opportunity to say that they didn't want to go on the mission. Of course, none of them did. He also informed them, you know, one more time, they would not be landing in Vladivostok, the Soviet Union. They would all be headed towards China. That's where they needed to go after the raid. His final statement to the men was, quote, "When we get to Chungking, I'm going to give you all a party that you won't forget," end quote. And it's a promise that he wasn't able to uphold, at least in Chungking, but he will, you know, possible foreshadowing, he would make good on that promise. So we get into April 18th, which is the day of the raid, April 18th of 1942. And that morning starts early, and it was an inauspicious beginning for the task force. At 3:10 in the morning, 800 miles from Japan, the Enterprise identified two vessels about 12 miles away from them. They identified them via radar. Later that morning, scout planes from the Enterprise spotted a fishing boat At 7:38, another patrol craft was spotted. This ship, a larger ship, was called the Nitto Maru number 23, and that ship radio Tokyo a little bit in error, but they did say three enemy carriers 600 miles from the closest Japanese shore, and basically the surprise was up. So the cruisers in the task force started firing on the ship. The fighters from the Enterprise were launched. They saw another ship, the Nitto Maru number 21, and so now there's a naval and air engagement of these two vessels. Both ships were eventually sunk, but throughout Japanese vessels were transmitting at least 27 minutes during the attack, and it was pretty clear now that Japan knew that the task force was there and that something was going on, that there were aircraft carriers. So on the deck of the Hornet, Mitcher tells Doolittle, it looks like it's going to be time for you boys to go. Halsey, from his ship, from the Enterprise, messaged the Hornet and said they need to launch their planes, and he put the order over the ship's loudspeaker, and then Mitcher did as well and directed the Army pilots to man their planes. At the time that the Hornet got the message, they were 824 miles from Tokyo, which would virtually ensure that the crews would have no chance to make their planned Chinese airfields, which is... I think really brave of Doolittle and his raiders that they were willing to still step up, you know, and get on those aircraft and go into what I wouldn't call a suicide mission, but certainly an incredibly high risk mission where there was very, very little chance they would be able to safely land. At 8:03 a.m. on Saturday, April 18th, 1942, the USS Hornet turned into the wind. Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle, at the controls of his lead B-25 bomber, just 467 feet of flight deck in front of him, just 6 feet of clearance from his right wingtip to the ship's island, pushed up the throttles, and at 8:20 he released the brakes and he was told to take off. He barreled down the flight deck, and the pretty choppy seas. And as he took off, it looked like the aircraft vanished below the deck, below the bow. And it looked to everybody that he had crashed. In fact, the pilot of the number two aircraft said, it looks like we lost Doolittle. But slowly the aircraft ascended into the overcast skies. The sailors on the deck went crazy and started cheering. And each aircraft after that, just a little bit more space than that 467 feet that Doolittle had. And amazingly, all of them got off the deck of the Hornet. Not without incident, the 16th and final B-25, before it was even able to take off, they were taking off at 3 to 5 minute intervals, so each aircraft taking off 3 to 5 minutes after the last one. The final one was nearly lost to a pretty significant wind gust. The aircraft was still tied down at the time, but its nose lifted, and it looked like it was actually going to fall into the water. So a bunch of sailors come over and start trying to pull the aircraft back down onto the deck. And in the fight to keep that aircraft tied down, the first significant injury of this raid, Seaman First Class Robert Wall stumbled into the left prop. He was grievously wounded. His arm was nearly cut off. He whispered to the Army aviator that was next to him, go get these guys. Eventually, he would lose his arm, but was able to survive. But despite this kind of jarring event that happened here on the last takeoff, all 16 aircraft were able to take off. They were headed to deliver their bombs on Japan, and now all they had to worry about is 800 miles of water, dead reckoning. It was overcast skies. They weren't able to use the stars. They were going to have a tough time getting to their targets, but get there and then worry about defenses that were warned based off of the ships that they ran into previously, the ships that they observed. So just one more time, it's amazing to me to try and think what these 80 crew members on these bombers, each of the 16 bombers and 5 air crew, were thinking in their minds as they take off much earlier than planned. There's just been a naval engagement. There's been shooting. They haven't been a part of this. This is their first combat mission, and they are going to be America's vengeance, right? Drop bombs on Japan. And I think it's also important to know that Japan at this time, really had this belief that their country could not be struck by invaders. They were the Empire of Heaven, and they would always be protected for 2600 years, I believe, no invader had struck at the Japanese home islands. And there was a feeling of just impenetrability among its citizens. And that was about to be pierced by the Doolittle Raiders. So in Japan, Admiral Yamamoto, the father of Pearl Harbor, who came up with the idea and led the attack, he received word and warning from the Nitto Maru that had sent the warning about the aircraft carriers. So Yamamoto sent it out to the fleet, but most of the fleet members, if you will, assumed that they still had a whole nother day. Because of the short range of carrier-based fighters, a carrier 800-plus miles from the coast was not in a position to threaten the coast. That's the difference between having Army medium bombers and Navy strike fighters. So the Raiders, they flew in low. One aircraft even hit a wave top, which is amazing. I mean, it was fine. And they used, like I said, dead reckoning to find the shores near their respective targets. Some of them a little bit more successfully than others, but they all eventually got to their targets. As the bombers roared over the coastal towns, their presence really appeared to be a surprise. Some of the crews even mentioned that people on the ground waved at them, probably thinking they were Japanese aircraft. Doolittle, in the lead bomber, observed at one point 9 Japanese fighters as they were getting close to the capital of Tokyo. But the raiders appeared to avoid detection. Those fighters never turned and committed on Doolittle's bomber. At 1:15 p.m. in the afternoon, Staff Sergeant Fred Bramer, that's Doolittle's bombardier, dropped 4 incendiary bombs on Tokyo. That was America's first strike back at the Empire of Japan for the devastating Pearl Harbor attack. And those 2,000 pounds of bombs really did kind of light damage, but what they did do was pierce the feeling of invincibility, that impenetrableness that I talked about, that island chain could never be hit, and that was pierced forever by those first 4 bombs. Some of the bombs, some of the bomblets would hit residential areas. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But despite the warnings from the Nitto Maru, there was really very light resistance. The raid was primarily a shock. So there were some anti-aircraft guns, but not really significant air defenses or significant Japanese fighter resistance. The bombers hit, and they designed to hit military and industrial targets in Tokyo, Yokohama, Yokosuka, Nagoya, Kobe, and Osaka. I think it's important to know at this point, not precision-guided munitions. It's not a very precise strike. So the bombers had their targets designed. They were supposed to be military and industrial targets, like business or organizations or companies that were supporting the war-fighting machine, the Japanese war-fighting machine. And among the 16 bombers and the 32,000 pounds of bombs, it was pretty light damage, especially with targets across Tokyo and some other cities. But pretty light damage. The casualty figures are really notoriously difficult in World War II in general, and this strike in particular. But I would say most sources generally say 50 to 100 Japanese were killed on the ground, 400 to as many as 1,000 injured. Japan at the time said something like 3,000 to 4,000 civilians were killed. That is a wildly inflated number. And they also, I should say, the Japanese did claim that there was heavy damage to non-military objectives like schools and hospitals. And there definitely was damage to residential areas, including schools. And not only is it talked about in Target Tokyo, but I think a great book on this is Last Mission to Tokyo that I had mentioned previously by Michael Paradis that covers what was hit and the collateral damage claims. I'm of the belief that these were not intentional strikes on residential areas. It is just a function of the bombing at the time, just not a very precise way of bombing. So getting to the end of this raid, if you will, and the end of this section, because of the early detection and the early takeoffs and the very long-range takeoffs that these bombers had to take, it didn't look like any of the aircraft would make their desired landing strips in China. One aircraft was particularly low on fuel. It was piloted by Captain Edward Ski York. For whatever reason, I don't know that they ever determined it. I don't think so. It was burning fuel at a significantly higher rate than planned and the other bombers. And there was simply no way that he would be able to reach China. So York and his crew made the split-second decision that they would go to Russia and Vladivostok. That was their only hope of making it. So he headed north there and eventually would land, and they would be held captive by the Soviets for a while. I'll get into that in part four. The other 15 aircraft headed southwest to China, and despite early concerns, the weather and the winds actually lessened a little bit, and it allowed the crews at least a chance to reach their assigned airfields. Unfortunately, and I could spend a whole podcast on the outcome of these aircraft and their crews, but there is a host of mistakes that happen on the ground, and the airfields aren't ready. Lights are not on, or fires not set at these airfields. The radios that are supposed to be there are either not there or not turned on. And the bottom line is not one of the aircraft is able to successfully land in China. Every one of them either crashes, ditches in the ocean, their crews bail out, whatever. All of them have to eventually crash or ditch. And in terms of what happened to the aviators, 580 aviators landed safely in Russia. 64 of the raiders were able to get to China and evade capture, some of them with just horrific injuries. They were helped significantly by local Chinese at great risk to themselves, the Chinese by that, I mean. And there will be horrific reprisals by the Japanese on the Chinese, and I'll get into that in the next section. Three aviators or three of the air crew were killed in action because of the crashes or the ditching, and eight were captured by the Japanese, all of which were horrifically tortured, and three of which were executed. Again, I would lead you to Paratus' last mission to Tokyo that covers the war crimes tribunal of the Japanese that were the guards and in some cases the executioners of these Doolittle raiders that were captured. The last thing I want to talk about in this section is really just a talk about what is my favorite picture of the Doolittle raid and maybe of all of World War II. And it's in most of the books that you can pick up and you can Google it. Doolittle's crashed B-25, you know, and you can find it. And of course, I'll post it on the social media. But it's a picture of Doolittle on April 19th, and he's sitting on the wing of his crashed B-25. And I'm going to pick up the description of it from James Scott's account in Target Tokyo. I'm just going to read kind of a block quote here, which I don't typically do, but I'm not going to be able to say it any better than Scott did. So Doolittle was pretty low, and now I'm going to start with the quote. According to Doolittle, I had never felt lower in my life. And then Scott comes in with crew chief Staff Sergeant Paul Leonard, who was Doolittle's crew chief. Leonard recognized the depth of Doolittle's despair, writing in his diary that the veteran aviator was disconsolate. "What do you think will happen to you when you go home, Colonel?" the crew chief dared to ask. "Well," Doolittle answered, "I guess they'll court-martial me and send me to prison at Fort Leavenworth." And my own note here, he had just lost 16 frontline bombers, 80 aviators on the ground. Doolittle felt that he had failed miserably. And I'll get back into Scott's depiction of this. "No, sir," Leonard fired back. "I'll tell you what will happen. They're going to make you a general." Doolittle offered a weak smile, recognizing Leonard's effort to buoy his spirits. And the crew chief continued, "They're going to give you the Congressional Medal of Honor." Doolittle did not respond. "Colonel, I know they're going to give you another plane, and when they do, I'd like to fly with you as your crew chief." Doolittle felt tears in his eyes. It was the supreme compliment that a mechanic could give a pilot, he later wrote. It meant he was so sure of the skills of his pilot that he would fly anywhere with him and under any circumstances. I love the disconsolate nature of Doolittle and the fact that his crew chief understood and cared so much about his pilot that he lifts him up. And really in wartime, it becomes a lot less about, you know, an officer, enlisted, pilot, crew chief. These are just aviators that are trying to survive on the ground. And there's a little bit more to the story. Leonard was absolutely right. Doolittle was not court-martialed. He was immediately promoted to general when he got back to the United States. He was awarded the Medal of Honor. He was given another airplane. He was given many more commands, eventually playing a major role in winning World War II and certainly in the air war, becoming the 8th Air Force commander. And he did stay with Leonard. They were together in Northern Africa. And World War II often has some pretty sad endings, and unfortunately this one as well. Tragically, Leonard was killed by an air attack in Algeria in 1943, and Doolittle was there with him and saw it all go down. He wrote a letter to Leonard's widow, which he later called, quote, "the saddest letter I ever wrote." And he also said, quote, "Paul's loss was my greatest personal tragedy of the war," end quote. So at the end of this section, we've gone through the raid in detail and at least the aviators getting on the ground, some of which captured, some of which really injured and some killed. And now we're going to get into the last part and then wrap this whole thing up, which is the enduring legacy of the Doolittle Raid. All right, here we are, part four. We made it, the enduring legacy of the raid. First, the raid buoyed American spirits. That pretty much goes without saying. In particular, President Roosevelt was thrilled. He playfully told reporters when asked where the aircraft came from that they took off from a small little island, Shangri-La, which was a well-known place in a fiction book that he liked. But I kind of think of it, and I actually go back to a Churchill quote that was not used for this raid at all, but after the Allied victory at Alamein in North Africa in November of 1942, Churchill famously said, "This is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning," which I love. But I see this quote as really apt for the Doolittle Raid's impact on the Pacific War. Was not the end, but really was the end of the beginning. And that first phase where Japan was steamrolling the U.S. and Britain across the Pacific. And this was the first way to not only halt Japanese momentum, but start to bring some offensive momentum to the United States and the Allies. And its impact, I think, really can't be understated. The U.S., this raid had pierced the veneer of Japanese invincibility. It had proven that we could take the fight to the Japanese. It breathed life into the American fighting spirit. And for those of us who were around after September 11th and remember the kind of visceral anger that we had and that desire for vengeance, it was the same thing was happening in 41 and 42 in America. And Americans were anxious. They were angry, and they wanted their vengeance, and this was the first opportunity to get that. And you know, in retrospect, we look at World War II, and it seems inevitable that we would win, that the Allies, that the good guys would win. But it was not always that way, and especially early on in the war, when it was just bad news after bad news after bad news, it's hard to hard to keep the positive thinking that things are going to go well. And this was the first real piece of evidence to the American people that there was a chance that the Americans and that the Allies would win. And pretty soon after this, there was the Battle of the Coral Sea, a relatively even battle, but kind of started the first halt of real Japanese momentum. And then after that, the Battle of Midway. And I think I'll get into Midway in just a minute, but that was an overwhelming victory for the United States. But I think you can make the argument that Japan's high watermark of the war was really April 17th of 1942. And yeah, they took the Philippines after that at the beginning of May. But I don't know that that was even more important than what happened with the Doolittle Raid. I really feel like that was the start of the second phase of the war, that the Japanese, the Pacific War, that the Japanese were no longer just going to have an unopposed run across the Asia Pacific, that the U.S. and its allies were coming back. So I like to think of Japan's high watermark as April 17th of 1942. The attack also had a big operational impact on the war in three ways, as I see it. The first is that Japan needed to change its perspective on defense. It had to keep more air and naval forces near the Japanese home islands, because where they previously believed that they were, that the islands were basically impenetrable, that was no longer the case, and they could no longer afford to leave relatively light defenses at the home islands. So they had to bring or keep back more air and naval forces. Those could not be used on the offense. And, you know, it's hard to say what, how much of an impact that had, but it certainly had an impact. In the United States starts to win the naval war, and then the island hopping campaign, and starts to turn the tide of the conflict. The second big operational impact is that Admiral Yamamoto, the commander-in-chief of the Japanese fleet, the designer and father of Pearl Harbor, if you will, wanted to correct the mistake that he made in Pearl Harbor, and he wanted to eliminate the threat to the Japanese home islands. And he made a major effort to eliminate the U.S. carriers, and decided that he wanted to fight a major battle in order to try and lure the carriers out and then destroy them and really end effective American naval power in the Pacific. And that will drive his effort in the Battle of Midway, which leads pretty well into my third operational impact, and one that I really care a lot about as an intelligence professional. But the raid enabled U.S. Navy codebreakers to break the Japanese naval code. And for anybody that's followed World War II or read about it, knows how important it was to break the Japanese naval code. We ended up calling that magic. So whenever you hear a magic intercept or whatever, that was the Japanese naval code. I could tell you what I think about it, but instead I'm going to use another block quote. This one is from a book that I really, really like, called from Winston Groom is the author, and it's called The Aviators, and it's about Eddie Rickenbacker, Jimmy Doolittle, and Charles Lindbergh, and I highly recommend it if you're interested in any one or all three of those air power pioneers. But let me quote from Groom. American intelligence, and in particular Lieutenant Commander J.J. Rochefort, had been working for years to break the complex Japanese naval code. His team had unraveled bits and pieces, but were stymied by the near-continuous radio silence imposed by Yamamoto on the Japanese fleet. Doolittle's shocking attack changed all of that. For several hours during and after the raid, a terrific amount of Japanese naval radio traffic went out, and all of it was just as quickly plucked from the airways by Allied listening stations and sent to Rochefort's headquarters at Pearl Harbor, where teams of codebreakers and intelligence analysts worked around the clock putting the pieces together. Before Doolittle's raid, Rochefort's team had managed to decipher some 10% of the code. A week after the raid, they were reading half of it. By the end of May, the time that Doolittle was getting his Medal of Honor, Rochefort's people were reading nearly all of it. I can't begin to describe how important it was that the raid caused Japan to send out tons of both encrypted and unencrypted communication. And by picking all of that up, Rochefort and his team had the ability to analyze it, to break it, and they started to make huge strides. And they put that to great effect throughout the rest of the Pacific campaign. They used it in particular, so I mentioned just above that Yamamoto decided he wanted to have a major battle and to lure the American carriers out and to try to find them in open waters and destroy them. And the codebreakers had figured that out and then eventually used a clever ruse to determine that Yamamoto was determined to target Midway Island. And a threat to Midway, he thought, would bring out the American carriers for a carrier battle. And that's exactly what happened. Admiral Nimitz used that actionable intelligence that Rochefort and his team had provided. He committed three of his aircraft carriers, including two of the ones that we've been talking about here, the Enterprise and the Hornet. And they met four Japanese carriers, and the U.S. sank all four of those Japanese carriers. The Americans did lose the USS Yorktown, but it was an overwhelming victory. It firmly turned the tide of the Pacific War, and Japan was never able to provide the kind of offense, their navy was never able to provide the offensive striking power that they were prior to the Battle of Midway. So you can kind of draw a line from the Doolittle raid, through the code breaking of Rochefort and his team, through to the actionable intelligence provided to Nimitz at Midway and the overwhelming and decisive victory at Midway that turned the tide of the Pacific War. So could you say that the Doolittle raid played a major role in winning the Pacific War? I think that you can, and I think that you should. But this code breaking didn't even, the big operational impacts didn't end there. In April of 43, Rochefort's team had a magic or another intercept that they were able to decrypt that showed an itinerary for Admiral Yamamoto. He was going to visit a base called Bougainville in the Solomon Islands. The United States Army Air Forces used this intelligence. They planned and they executed a mission to intercept and shoot down Yamamoto's aircraft. And on April 18th, 1943, exactly 1 year after the Doolittle raid, a group of P-38 Lightnings were able to find and shoot down Yamamoto's aircraft and gave America kind of that final vengeance for Pearl Harbor by taking down the man most responsible. And as somebody who remembers the feeling when bin Laden was taken down, I can imagine that that was the feeling that swept America. And there's a big, you know, pretty straight line from the Doolittle raid to the breaking of the code to being able to get Yamamoto. So a lot of great consequences for the U.S. and the Allies, but one ally that did not have it nearly as well, the consequences for the Chinese were devastating. Enraged by the attack and the help that the Chinese provided the Doolittle raiders, Japan initiated Operation Saigo. It was a brutal attack against the easternmost provinces that hid and supported and helped the raiders get back. And it was an offensive that was brutal in nature. Estimates vary. The Chinese say 250,000 Chinese were killed in this operation. Some say maybe that's a little bit high. Nonetheless, I think all sources that I saw were putting the number of killed in six figures. An unbelievably high price to pay for the Doolittle raid. It's a part of the story that is not talked about enough, but certainly the Chinese paid a heavy, heavy price for helping out the Doolittle raiders. The raiders themselves actually paid a relatively low price in the concept of war and the overwhelming misery that World War II had. There only three died in the raid. Staff Sergeant William Dieter and Staff Sergeant Donald Fitzmaurice drowned when their aircraft ditched in the ocean. Corporal Leland Factor died in a bailout attempt. They were the only killed in action. There were some others that have pretty horrific injuries that took years to recover from, but only three were killed in the actual mission. Eight crewmen were captured, and they suffered greatly at the hands of the Japanese. They were tortured pretty significantly. All of them were sentenced to death. Some of them had that sentence commuted, but stayed in prisoners of war camp until the end of the war. But three were actually executed in August of 1942. First Lieutenant Dean Hallmark, First Lieutenant William Farrow, and Corporal Harold Spatz were executed. A little bit later that year, First Lieutenant Robert Meader died on December 1st, 1943. I guess it was later in 1943. He died in captivity from injuries that he had sustained in the raid and captivity and just unbelievably horrible conditions that the raiders were kept in. The Doolittle raid still is kind of forward in the minds of air power thinkers and military analysts, and virtually any conflict that you see, there will be a Doolittle raid of X conflict, or somebody will come up with the idea for a Doolittle raid. And April 1st of this year, the Ukrainians had their Doolittle raid. At least some analysts have called it that. A couple of Ukrainian MiG-24s came in low altitude and attacked and destroyed a fuel storage site in Belgorod, Russia. It definitely sent shockwaves at the time. I think it's quite a stretch to call it the Doolittle raid of the Ukraine war. I actually think the sinking of the Moskva would be more akin to the Doolittle raid, even though it was a missile strike. That had more of a shockwave for the Russians, I believe, than that Mi-24 attack. But nonetheless, the idea of a Hail Mary pass or really going for it all on one mission to have a shocking effect kind of out of proportion of the mission itself is still a concept that is around even in the war that we're seeing today. I mentioned a promise that Doolittle made to his raiders the night before. He made good on that promise. It took a lot longer than he thought. The party did not happen in Chongqing. But he did show the raiders a party like they hadn't seen before and wouldn't forget. And it ended up happening in Miami in 1946. And they basically tore a hotel apart. And it started a reunion tradition that was unbroken pretty much until 2013. And it kind of transitioned from a reunion that was a big party, especially as the raiders started to get older, to more of a ceremony. In 1959, the city of Tucson, Arizona, presented the raiders with 80 silver goblets that were engraved with the name of each of the raiders. And they ended up being held at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And the goblets would be held would be face up if the raider was still alive, and then when the raider passed, it was turned over. And every year when the raiders would get together, they would toast, they would get cognac, and they would toast to the raiders that they had lost and those that had passed, and then they would recognize those that had passed away that year. The last of these ceremonies was in 2013. Four surviving members were able to meet up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, but all of them were getting pretty old and decided not to do it in person anymore. On April 9th of 2019, almost 77 years to the day after the attack, Lieutenant Colonel Dick Cole, who was Doolittle's co-pilot on the lead aircraft, passed away at 103 years old. He was the last surviving member of the Doolittle Raiders. But the tradition continues even just today. I'm finishing this recording on April 18th. General C.Q. Brown, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, is taking part in the goblet ceremony to recognize the importance of what the Doolittle Raiders did and the legacy that they still have in the United States Air Force. The Doolittle Raid is one of the most important air operations in history. I've tried to make the argument on why I think it changed the course of World War II. They were and they remain American heroes, and unfortunately we don't have any more of the Doolittle Raiders around, but I think the fact that you've probably seen what I saw on social media today, a lot of posts and people remembering the Doolittle Raiders and what they did, just maybe the most audacious air operation in the history of war. So it was my honor to be able to talk a little bit about the Doolittle Raid, maybe my favorite mission, air operation mission in history. So that does it for this episode. I don't think I really need to do the disclaimer because there weren't a whole lot of my opinions, but if I did put any opinions out there, those are mine alone and not the official position of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. If you liked this episode, if you didn't like this episode, if you heard an error or whatever, hit me up on social at AirMindedPod, at Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, what am I forgetting? LinkedIn, again, I never check it. I'm also been getting a lot of emails from you all. I am a little bit behind. I'm going to be catching up as soon as I put this episode to bed, but I'm definitely very happy to hear from all of you and appreciate all the engagement that you've been given. So until the next episode, thank you for tuning in. This is your host, Tyson Wetzel, saying thanks a lot.